tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in D.C. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in D.C., and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. Lunch Agenda is a podcast that schools you on undercovered parts of the food system that I think we all need to know more about. You can check out recent interviews with D.C.-based leaders from the Capital Area Food Bank, Dreaming Out Loud, and 4P Foods, as well as with national food advocates like Mark Bittman, Marion Nessel, and Julia Tertian. All those interviews are on your favorite podcast app, and behind-the-scenes info and episode picks are at kikosfoodnews.com or KikoBuff on Instagram. Today, I'm really excited to dive into the first episode of a new Lunch Agenda series all about institutional food, in conversation with Spike Jurdy of A Rake's Progress and Jesse Silverman of Center for Science in the Public Interest.
It's this idea, again, of institutional food. It just doesn't matter. And presumably, the most people on earth are being fed through institutional food. Obviously not through restaurants, not through your $13 salad that you get on the street, or a burrito or a sandwich that costs $15 on the street. It's through institutional food.
So that's not Spike, and that's not Jesse. I wanted to bring in just a couple quotes from Dan Giusti. I hope I said that right. Dan is a real hero in institutional food of the school variety. After serving as the head chef of Noma in Copenhagen, Dan decided institutional food was his future, and he founded Brigade, which has overhauled the cafeterias of several school districts across the country, starting in New London, Connecticut, and continuing to the entire borough of the Bronx. So, truth be told, we've already learned a lot about institutional food on Lunch Agenda so far in the area of school food. So, for example, if you look back to episode 7 of the show in the Food at School series, I talked with food service leaders from a D.C. charter school, Mundo Verde, where I now work, and school food service leaders from the Fairfax, Virginia School District. Therefore, in this series, we're going to look at three other kinds of institutions. We're going to look at hotels today, we'll look at hospitals next week, and then we'll finish off with two episodes on food and correctional facilities. What I'm hoping to give you in each episode is complementary perspectives from both practitioners who live the challenges and successes of institutional food, which today will come via Spike, and researchers or advocates who offer a broader systems view, and today that will be Jesse. So before we start chatting, though, as always, we're going to catch up on the week in the food system with a little Kiko's Food News. Headline one for this week. New York City officials announced that Meatless Mondays is expanding to all of the city's public schools. The program, which was first piloted in 15 Brooklyn schools in 2018, will become a citywide initiative beginning next school year. The expansion is predicted to be cost neutral, and the Department of Education is meeting with students to get qualitative feedback before the menu is finalized. Hurrah for this huge example of institutional food, which is going to have mitigate the environmental impact of that institution through lowered meat consumption. Second headline, zooming out to a national challenge to local food systems. The number of farmers markets has increased from 2,000 in 1994 in the USA to more than 8,600 across the country as of this year. So that sounds positive, but a problem is emerging where there may be too few farmers to populate market stalls and too few customers filling their bags with fresh produce at each market. Reports of farmers markets closing have affected communities across the country, with markets in big cities hurting too. For example, the Copley Square market in Boston reported a 50% drop in attendance in 2017. I'm looking at Spike to ask him if he has any perspective, you know, from experience with Fresh Farm, with DC area farmers on this. Do you see this happening around here?
I have so much. I've heard about these reports and I have so much perspective. It almost feels like a whole other show. but I disagree fundamentally with the notion that it's too many farmers markets is the problem. There are other problems that are fueling this decline.
So where are customers shopping if not farmers markets? Do you feel that farmers markets have less customers in the DC area?
Possibly. I think part of the problem is a structural problem with farmers markets. They don't serve farmers or customers particularly well. And they do some things extraordinarily well, and I think it's still one of the best places to get yourself in front of a farmer and talk to them. But unfortunately, there are other aspects that are, in my mind, somewhat a little broken.
All right. Maybe a part
There's
two.
There's a lot more to talk about, but it's unfortunate that this is what's happening.
But it's not as black and white as too many farmers markets.
It sure isn't.
Okay. Good to hear. It didn't make sense to me that growth would have the reverse effect.
Right.
So we're going to pause there on that headline and just take it one more headline for today, coming out of New York City. The latest debate over cultural appropriation in food erupted recently when a white restaurateur opened Lucky Lee's, a Chinese-American restaurant on Manhattan's Upper East Side. The owner is a health coach who wanted to open the kind of Chinese restaurant where, quote, she and her food-sensitive clients could eat. And on Instagram, she claimed that her lo mein, quote, wouldn't make people feel bloated and icky the next day, end quote, and that she wouldn't serve food that wasn't, quote, too oily or salty, end quote. So while she claimed to be contemplating complementing an important cuisine in a way that would cater to people that have certain dietary requirements, critics said she was claiming her food to be superior to food made by actual Asians. And this connotation that other Chinese food is unhealthy or unclean is a stereotype that Chinese restaurateurs have been fighting for decades. So really interesting, clash of perspectives going on there. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm eager to bring Jesse and Spike into the conversation to talk all about hotel food. So stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. This is Kiko, your host, and you've tuned into an episode all about hotel food. So apropos, because we're sitting in a beautiful hotel in the heart of DC. And this is the first in our series on food in various institutional settings. I'm inspired by institutional food as an opportunity area. This is a topic I've wanted to cover for months because the buyers who purchase ingredients in these huge institutions have such a huge opportunity for impact on our environment, on the health of those eating the food, on the growers and producers. So we're going to hear about those purchasing choices in a moment from Spike Jurdy, who does that hard work for this very hotel. But I want to first ground us in the broader landscape of hotel food. I've benefited from a recent report by the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which I'm going to call from now on CSPI, on the healthfulness of food service in hotels and convention centers. And I'm lucky to be joined today by Jesse Silverman, who prepared that report. Hey, Jesse.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And to share about your background, Jesse's a policy fellow at CSPI who works to increase access to healthier foods on public property, including work sites and in other institutions outside of hotels. She recently completed the Master of Science in Public Health and Registered Dietitian program at Johns Hopkins University, and she holds a Bachelor's in Nutritional Sciences from Cornell. So, Jesse, I know that at CSPI, you research food procurement and policies in all kinds of institutional settings. Can you tell us a little bit about the work of CSPI in this particular segment of institutions, in hotels, just generally, what are the goals of your organization in doing research and advocating about hotel food?
Sure. So let me just give you a little bit of background about CSPI. So we're a nonprofit food policy organization, and our main goal is to make it easier for people to eat healthfully. So in our food environment, eating healthfully can sometimes feel like trudging through deep snow. It's not impossible, but it can be exhausting. So at CSPI, we clear a path for people through the snow. And so we work on policies at the federal, state, and local level. And sometimes we look at company policies, not just public policies. And one approach that we've taken is to try to improve the food environment in work sites. People spend a ton of time at work. Sometimes they eat a lot of their meals and snacks at work. And particularly the food served in meetings is notoriously unhealthy. And some of your listeners can probably relate to coming to a breakfast meeting that's all, you know, bagels and donuts, or a lunch meeting that's all pizza and soda. And so that interest in improving the food environment in meetings is how we got to be looking at hotels, because hotels provide food for organizations that are hosting meetings, and it could be millions of people each year that are attending meetings and eating the food served at hotels. So I just joined the staff of CSPI a few weeks ago, but I was an intern at CSPI in 2016, and one of my projects was to do this research into what is the food service like for meetings at hotels, because no one had really looked at before what is the general landscape of the healthfulness of food at hotels, to see kind of like how much work there is to be done to make healthier meetings more accessible in those settings.
And was the goal to then filter this information back to hotel chefs, hotel food buyers, you know, to the hotels themselves, or expose it to the public, or both?
So I think going into it, we weren't quite sure what we would find. And so we kind of thought we'll see what's out there and then kind of find out what to do with it afterward. But I think we, you know, thought it might be possible we might be reaching out to some hotels to make recommendations, or also just figure out how to provide resources to organizations that are planning meetings so that they can navigate the catering process better.
And so what is out there? What kind of findings did you have?
Yeah, so I just want listeners to keep in mind that this is just a snapshot in time from 3 years ago, so some things might have changed. And we were looking at like big chain hotels. So the ones that we looked at were the Wyndham, Holiday Inn, Hilton, Marriott, Sheraton, Radisson, and Hyatt. So that's the kind of places that I'm able to speak to. And we also looked at convention centers in this report as well, because they host meetings and conferences frequently. So our big questions were, what healthy options are available? Are the choices that are being promoted as healthy, are they consistent with our nutrition guidelines? So CSPI has developed guidelines for food service at healthy meetings. And then we were looking to see if any venues might have a model healthy catering package that we could highlight. So overall, the venues I mentioned, we found that there were sort of a standard set of menu choices that were offered to meeting planners at each eating occasion. So you might have like several breakfast buffets to choose from, or like plated meals at each meal that you could choose from to serve. And most of the choices that were available would not support healthy eating, according to our
offenses?
Guidelines.
Why not?
So there were sort of the general offenders we find in all kinds of American food service meals: high in saturated fat, or low, you know, have a lot of refined grains, and there would be bread and butter served with everything, or just traditional desserts included with every meal. There were, you know, oftentimes fruits and vegetables served at every meal, which is a good thing, but it was hard to tell what the portion sizes were like, whether, you know, it could be a teeny portion of vegetables and a huge portion of meat. So it was also one of the issues that we ran into, was just that it was just hard to tell from just looking at menus what the nutrition content would be, or the portion sizes, which is important to be able to evaluate that. But one of our big takeaways also was that most sites had one or more items that they promoted as healthy, but there were a lot of caveats to that generalization. So there might be a healthy option for breakfast, but not for any other meal. And also, you know, the options that were promoted as healthy were not usually based on any nutrition guidelines. And so the reason that's important is because people can have different definitions of healthy. And so we want to ensure that those definitions are based on nutrition science. So like there might be a breakfast buffet that was advertised as healthy, but they include, you know, banana bread and blueberry muffins and these items that are probably traditional pastries, but they sort of have this, what we would describe as a health halo, because they have fruit in them.
Health halo, that's a useful term.
Yeah.
You see that a lot. So then what are the bright lights? You know, if a listener is listening today and going to some city with a Marriott and a Wyndham or, you know, all the chains that you just mentioned and wants to situate themselves amongst the healthiest options, what are some hotels doing it well?
So we did find one really great example. So the company that owns the Radisson chain, they have like a little more upscale brand called Radisson Blue that they only have a couple properties in the US. Most of them are in Europe, but they have this meeting package that they call Brain Food for Meetings, and they developed it with nutritionists and chefs, and all of their menu items are based on these six nutrition principles that are publicly available online. And I think the great thing about it is that they promote it as sort of the default catering package for their meeting planners.
And the last question I want to ask you about with regard to the report before bringing Spike into the conversation is whether you discerned any interesting trends or information about procurement. You know, were you looking at you know, local sourcing or responsible sourcing, or was it really more focused on consumer health in terms of, you know, nutrients and food groups and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so in our report, we were really focusing on nutrition. Okay. Sustainability is a very important issue as well, but that was sort of beyond the scope of our research.
Sure. So then let's turn it over to Spike to hear about how I think he focuses on that here. You know, I think one bright light, no doubt, is what Spike has done here at the Line DC. So just quick background in case any listener doesn't know about him. Spike is a James Beard Award winner. Recently nicknamed the DMV's ultimate locavore chef in an article I just saw. He drew national attention with his Woodbury Kitchen in Baltimore, for which he won Best Chef Mid-Atlantic in 2015. But A Rake's Progress is his first restaurant outside of Baltimore, and that's the restaurant he opened right here at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan last year. I liked how that website described you, Spike, as a learner and a teacher of the terroir of the region, only using ingredients found within his food system. And it's worth noting that Spike is also a radio host of Origins, which you could tell our listeners about as well. So welcome, Spike.
Thanks. It's great to be in a different
yes, seat. Yes, I'm proud to be hosting your guest debut on Full Service Radio. So I want to talk about your transition to hotel food. And let's just kind of start with what you had built in Baltimore. So can you give our listeners a little bit of understanding about who might not be familiar with Woodbury Kitchen or your coffee shop Artifact there, how you thought about taking those and, you know, building your new concepts here at the Line with A Rake's Progress and A Cup We All Raise For?
Absolutely. You know, Woodbury opened in 2007, and I like to describe it more as a question than a concept. I'm ambivalent about the word concept when it's used in with restaurants.
It's played out
a little bit. And we opened with this, and the question I guess we were asking is like, what's the best way to feed ourselves? And that last 11 and a half years have been kind of spent answering that and finding ever kind of, I think, kind of refining that answer. And what you enjoy at Woodbury to this day is kind of our best answer to that question. And for me, a lot of that has been solved, I guess, on some level locally. I feel like our local food system here answers that question very, very well in a lot of different ways. And when it comes to fish and shellfish or meat and other proteins, when it comes to grains, when it comes to fresh produce. And it just so happens that I decided to try this in one of the best places on earth, really, to try to answer that. Because the Mid-Atlantic, the area around and including the Chesapeake, is a spectacularly productive place.
Remind me, are you from the Mid-Atlantic?
I was born in Iowa, okay. Another different kind of food system right now, but moved here when I was 6 and I've lived kind of around here ever since. So I really consider myself a product of this place and very engaged with what goes on here when it comes to food. So Woodbury was this kind of, and continues to be this kind of work in progress around how do we do this, and working directly with local growers has become kind of the thing that I probably spend most of my time doing. Artifact, a coffee shop that we opened about 5 years later, kind of tried to do that, answer that same question, but in a different way, you know, in a coffee shop with soup, salad, sandwiches at a price point that I think, you know, was at least made some sense to folks. And, you know, it's just a different, but it was just, it's as focused on answering those questions and sourcing locally and sourcing directly from growers and supporting growers as Woodbury is. The opportunity here, you know, came along and we started talking to the folks at Seidel, and it just jumped out at me almost like the opportunity around not only doing a restaurant and a hotel in D.C. And D.C. made so much sense because it's really, you know, if you know Baltimore and D.C., they're very close. They share the same kind of agricultural region. And so I felt like I had kind of the basis to do this here in D.C.
as opposed to reinvent whole
exactly.
new sourcing relationships.
And we've worked with a lot of the same farmers here as we do up in Baltimore, but we've met some new ones and it's been great. And we're continuing to grow and learn about resources that we hadn't been as focused on in Baltimore. We had kind of a northern view, and it feels like here in D.C. we're looking a little more southern, back down into Virginia, which
right.
is an incredible state. So, but one of the things that jumped out at me is the opportunity here in the hotel was banquets, and not just because banquets can be a cash cow. And you know, it was much more. We can take what we've done at Woodbury, and apply that to banquets. And I've never seen, and to this day, I've never kind of seen or heard of anything like that. Which was take this intense local sourcing, this commitment to buying from local growers, and translate that to a hotel banquet business.
So was there any part of you that said, oh God, no, hotel food. I don't want to do hotel food. Like what were the red flags for you? What intimidated you?
None.
Okay.
In fact, one of the things that we got to do that we get to do here, which was even more exciting, was we get to do the food in our staff cafeteria. And so that was like what, you know, to take what Dan was saying earlier in the clip that you played, that was, I'm just excited when we get to find ways to bring this food to people that may otherwise wouldn't be getting it. And that sounds, I mean, and there's just miles to go before we sleep, but to do it in a hotel. And the first time we set up a banquet and I saw the food going down, and it was like, it was the food that we've been doing at Woodbury for a decade. And here was a tech company that otherwise, you know, they didn't ask for it. And, you know, they didn't, whether or not, you know, what they realized about what they were eating, it didn't matter. At that point, they were eating it. They were enjoying it. It was being served. You know, there was a DJ. You know, it was a banquet in a hotel, and it was our food. Our growers were getting paid, and I was over the moon.
So I'm trying to picture this banquet, and I'm wondering how you use that as an educational opportunity for that tech company. Do you, you know, tell them the story in any way, or do you just kind of sit back, know that you're doing bigger buys from these farmers and these producers, and just kind of rest there that they're going to love the flavors?
It's completely up to the client.
Uh-huh.
And here we're working very closely with the hotel. They do the sales and the service. We provide the food and beverage. And that partnership alone has been incredibly beneficial to me, because I get to see them sell what I do to clients that otherwise either aren't expecting it, maybe aren't asking for it. And sometimes they have to have a conversation around the fact that we don't have citrus, or, you know, other aspects of what we do that are important to us and that make sense to us, because ultimately what we're trying to do is return value to growers here. And it's been incredible the way that they've been able to manage that.
And also picturing the banquet, I'm just curious to get a sense of what can't happen in that setting. Like, what have you had to sacrifice when you are doing a hotel and maybe, you know, exponentially by 10 or 100 increasing your buys? You know, are you not able to source from certain producers because they can't meet that minimum?
Right. There are definitely farmers that are not working at that scale. There are tons that are, and probably tons more that are ready. I mean, scratch a farmer and you'll find an entrepreneur underneath. And most of the farmers I know are looking for markets and looking for opportunities. And the capacity in our local food system is definitely there. And when we've been able to up things here with chicken, say, or something, with a grower that we used to get 12 from at a time and now we're getting 120. I mean, there's some work to be done planning that and making sure that, you know, that we're all aware. But we had those conversations for a year before we opened with growers who were excited to have, you know, to be able to scale a little bit with us.
And one of the most beautiful things that I think the line has ever done is hosted all of your growers for that opening night of A Rake's Progress and put them up in the hotel, and they were the opening team. It was beautiful.
It was a magical moment, and that still gives me chills as you talk about it. And and it was a great way to kind of start here, because those are the growers that are still providing food for our stuff here in the hotel. And I will say, you know, I don't have as big a view into what it takes to do this in a larger property. We're having tremendous success here, and we do have folks that are coming looking for what we do, that want a truly local kind of meal on their event, on their banquet plate, and we're really happy to provide that. I do know that people that are in institutional settings are solving for a lot of the same things that we solve for, and they have the capacity to do this. And, you know, Hopkins is somebody I've talked to a lot about this in the past, about, you know, what it would take to bring more. They've made a commitment to bring more local food and healthier food into their food service, whether it's at the university or hospital. And I think there's, when I talk to professionals that are engaged at that level and they have tremendous resources, and I see a lot of what I do, and I do it in this way that with this focus on returning value to growers, but this isn't an impossibility. This is something that a lot of these institutions are already set up to do on some level, and with a kind of a shift in how they think about it, or, you know, what their kind of priorities are, it could very easily happen. Maybe not to the extent that we do it here. We're willing to kind of fight some of the battles that are still, I think, a little bit in the distance for a lot of folks, but a lot could happen quickly with local and healthy food, with just a little bit of a change in thinking.
So, Jesse, when you hear Spike say that, and you think about, you know, some of the contacts that you were working with at the bigger hotel groups, what kind of obstacles did you hear that are keeping them maybe from, you know, what Spike is doing at A Rake's Progress? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. In our
or what's keeping them even from improving the health standards that you're kind of challenging them to improve?
Sure. So in our report, we weren't looking specifically at what the obstacles are for hotels, but I think in general among food service providers, we've seen that they kind of don't think people will like the healthier foods. And I think with the right recipes and the right marketing, if you educate people about, you know, how important it is to have healthier foods, or that healthier foods can taste good, because they really can, then we've seen that healthier options can be really popular.
I assume price point is the big elephant in the room here.
Well, price
too.
Point always is, and you got to, like, it's something you have to kind of lean into. When I ran around for a long time saying, like, we're trying to return value to growers and get more dollars into growers' pockets. And what I didn't acknowledge at the time was that that's going to cost a little more. It does. I think a huge barrier to this are the contractual obligations that exist in this part of the food system. And procurement was a word that came up before, and I think it is a huge barrier. Again, I've seen this in public schools, and I've seen it in hotels, and there are these contracts that are drawn up. I've seen this at Hopkins, where a certain percentage has to be purchased from certain vendors, and it's a tremendous drag on anything different happening, because they go back to the contract and they say, we can't do it. And that's a big problem. And, you know, there's a small window that's allowed, you know, that can be purchased locally or something. But until those kind of contracts are rethought and the folks that are signing them, either on behalf of public school systems or institutions like universities, until that's kind of rethought and there's kind of a stranglehold on institutional food service, that's a barrier. The barrier, in other words, isn't can this be done? Are the farmers there to provide these products? No. The barriers are more around kind of structural contractual obligations that are made on behalf of universities, and a lot of times around cost.
So I'm curious to talk about structure and policy even. You know, I don't know enough about historical policy around hotels or other institutions that rely on contracts as their key buying channels. And I know, Jesse, that something that came out of your report is, or not something that came out of your learnings, but something that maybe you shared with me in advance, is one of the challenges is that hotels are privately owned, and so they're not subject to public policy nutrition standards. So is there anything in the works that first of all, Spike, would change the default contractual status quo? And Jesse, I'm curious to hear from you about any policies that are helping things, or what might shift, what might incentivize or motivate hotels to, you know, maybe buy more expensive inputs or put more effort into marketing of the healthier options, or anything that's more kind of systems level.
So I would just echo what Spike said about incorporating any, you know, food improvement initiatives into contract agreements with distributors when we're thinking about institutional food. That's definitely a big refrain that we see in a lot of our work on institutional food, that if it's not in the contract, then it's going to be really hard to enforce. Looking at hotels specifically, I would say that there are some company policies that I learned about doing this research that could make healthy meetings a little more challenging for meeting planners. The sales reps at the hotels that I spoke to were always like very willing to customize for any meeting planner that would want to have a healthier meeting. But some of these company policies in place would make that a little more challenging. And also it would really put the onus on the meeting planner to sort of have the nutrition savvy to talk about how they want foods prepared and, you know, what, you know, how to customize all of the items that are in the standard menu. And one of the interesting things that we heard about to kind of look at the other side of how pricing can kind of play into this was that say that a meeting planner wants to order 50% vegetarian plated meals, and so they're ordering half vegetarian meals and some chicken and some fish and some steak or something like that. Some of these venues have a policy that they will charge per plate the price of the highest price of the plated entrees for all those plated meals. So you would be paying the price of the steak for all of the vegetarian meals, which can really get in the way of you know, meeting planners wanting to do that. And additionally, they may have a food and beverage minimum purchasing for any organizations. For like a conference, they might have to buy a certain amount of food and beverage. And so if you want to elect not to have snack breaks or serve smaller portions, that can be a challenge as well. But I think in terms of positive policies that we would like to see, we would want to see hotels having guidelines about what healthy foods are being served. So if they're going to serve something healthy, it should be based on, or anything designated as healthy certainly should be based on nutrition guidelines that are based on science. And we would also encourage organizations that are planning meetings to have healthy meeting policies that can guide how they're navigating the catering planning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had asked you a question about contracts, but anything that you would want to say in response to what Jesse said?
I think the market is going to drive it. And, you know, until folks are demanding healthier options or God forbid, local options there. I mean, and I hope to provide that. Like, so that's out here at the Line Hotel. And this, that, right now, this is the place to get that. And I'm hoping that some people will be like, oh, we want that. And then maybe they'll go down the street to another hotel and be like, we want this thing that we, you know,
someone
we want to
compete with the
Line. Yeah, yeah. And so that's, I mean, it's not truly an advantage right now, what I'm offering. I mean, it's something that I do because I believe in it right down to my core, but it's not truly like a market advantage that we provided. We're doing it and it's working. I hope more folks do it. But when the market starts to drive it and people are asking for healthy options, that's when things will really start to change. But, you know, my heart goes out to the event planners who are always, they're the ones that are kind of caught in between, you know, what the hotel is offering and what they're kind of, and what the client or their client or whoever they're planning or working on behalf of,
right.
And what, and they're trying to, you know, accommodate and make the
best of the situation.
Yeah, and the guests happy, you know, and that's, I get that that's tricky. And then they have me come along and say, no, you can't have potato chips.
No potato chips?
Potato chips are a great snack, I guess, on some level, but when did they become part of a meal? It's
at a snack bar or something at a beach.
Well, it was actually, there's an answer to that question. It was some potato chip guy said, you know, marketing guy said, but this thing that was heretofore a snack is now part of a meal, and he put it next to a sandwich, and then it became, and that's not cool. It shouldn't be part of a meal.
Potato chips. Are you doing instead of
we make chips? Vegetable chips. And so these are raw radishes and carrots and turnips and kohlrabi, and they have a little bit of J.Q. Dickinson salt and or an herb salt or a little fish pepper salt that we make. And it's really, really good. And the thing is, it's got a little salt hit, just a little, and it's delicious and it's crispy. And you're eating that. It's not fried. It's raw. And you actually end up kind of snacking on them the way you would a potato chip, because for me, potato chips are like gateway drug. I mean, you just start, boom, you're eating potato chips. And
you got the texture, you got the salt.
Yeah.
I was actually really excited. I was in California for spring break last week and saw Dickinson salt, like, stocked in abundance in all the fancy stores.
Where?
We were in San Francisco.
Well, it shouldn't be out there. No, I don't.
Do they make salt out there?
Yeah, they Jacobson is the kind of the big West Coast.
Okay. All right.
But I'm happy for them. If they're selling salt in the West Coast, then they're doing something right. As long as there's enough for us.
So I want to ask.
I was the first chef that went out there. I'm on record. I got an email, and the next day I was in the car and I drove out to West Virginia and met with Nancy. And
I have heard you tell that story.
Thank you.
That is a source of pride for Spike.
Clearly.
For giving Spike credit for that. Two questions that I feel like any hotel guest kind of wonders about, and now we have someone who's doing it who might be able to answer it. Number one, food waste at buffets. What do you do with all the food that's left in the chafing dish? Like, you know, what do you do with all the extra buffet food?
So much of what we're talking about seems to be this path dependence where we expect things to be a certain way. And I've been, you know, at these conferences where we are actually debating like the future of food, and then you go out and the food sucks. It's like this god-awful spread. It's exactly what you're describing. And this is a conference where we're actually trying to figure out what's going to happen with food. And then the food that we're eating is actually undermining all the big, great ideas that are being shared.
You would be surprised how many nutrition conferences are where the healthy choices are few and far between.
Yeah.
And who doesn't... What I understand is, at that moment, why don't people just say, screw it, I'm out. Like, they just fill up their plates.
Lunch?
Yeah.
Oh.
Like,
because we're animals.
No, we can miss a meal, right? Is that? Can we?
I mean, I definitely sometimes eat before I go to some of these things. I have some dietary restrictions, so that also kind of it plays into that.
Right.
But I've seen that enough that I'm just like, this is beyond bizarre, and I'll just take a picture. So, sorry.
But so, I mean, if there's food left in the chafing dish, can you give it to staff or?
We really try not to make the cafeteria food that we do here leftovers.
Uh-huh.
So no.
Yeah.
It's a path dependent. We have to figure out. We don't put the massive displays out.
Right.
We just don't do that because there's so much waste that goes along with that. We're not going to reuse food that's been out, you know, that has kind of left our kind of chain of custody. So our thinking is we do smaller display. We don't like have this massive amount of food that's out that then just goes back to the kitchen. We try to pace it out. We try to keep it fresh and beautiful. And at the end, we're done.
That makes sense.
And it's, but it's, it is a tough balance to strike because people want to see that. And, but we, it's not easy.
And from a nutrition standpoint, is the buffet a recommended format for hotel food? Or like, are you trying to move, you know, guide hotels away from buffets because they encourage overeating from a health standpoint, Jesse?
Well, if all the choices on the buffet were, you know, consistent with our healthy guidelines, I don't think we'd be so worried about that. But we do have suggestions for how to, you know, improve.
How to nudge.
How to nudge. Yeah, very good. How to nudge people toward the healthier options. So, like, putting the fruits and vegetables at the front of the buffet will encourage people to take them more often. And also, we do suggest that meeting planners order food for buffets for less than the number of people they're actually expecting, and that will help control waste as well as portions.
I like that. I'm always under ordering and getting criticized for it, but I'm usually right.
But the, you know, on the event planner side, the biggest ding, like if you run out of food, people will lose their marbles.
Right.
So I get, again, once again, the event planner is kind of in the
rock and a hard place.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, so my last little curiosity before we wrap up with our action item is room service. So we don't have Eric Bruner Yang in here, but I'm just curious, Spike, you know, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Eric, he's the chef. He's another beloved DC chef, or not another, because Spike was a Baltimore chef, but he does the restaurant in the lobby of the Line Hotel called Brothers and Sisters, a little Japanese-inspired wood grill restaurant called Spoken English, and he does the room service here. Has he shared anything with you about, like, oh my God, I was great at running several restaurants, but room service, man, that's like a whole nother challenge, and I, you know, this is the trickiest part about it, or anything like that?
Not specifically. I will say that when I heard that Eric, you know, when we kind of talked about who was going to do what here, the fact that he had room service was not disputed by me. It's not easy. I know that he's gone through a lot of like different iterations of that service and what he's trying to do in a really high quality way, something that conforms to his very high quality way of presenting food, but is still
approachable
and still makes sense and still can be executed, you know, 3 a.m. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. I don't begrudge him that chore.
I really enjoyed the beautiful cake room service the night I stayed here, though. His cakes are very special.
Yes. Pichet is a otherworldly talent.
Yes. So I want to have time for your action items. And I warned you both.
Nobody told me about any action. I didn't.
Okay, but go ahead. You're going first, just because you said that. So I always ask guests, as I told you, for one thing that listeners can do in their day-to-day lives. It doesn't have to do with hotel food, to improve the food system in a way that you define the food system as needing improvement. You know, what do you tell your friends and family to change about their food lives? Spike.
Can Jesse go first?
Jesse, do you have one? Can you save him?
Mine is a little more straightforward. Okay. So in keeping with what I've been talking about today, I would encourage all the listeners to take our Healthy Meeting Pledge on behalf of their organization. So you can go to healthymeeting.org, and the link to take the Healthy Meeting Pledge is really obvious, and there are a lot of resources there for any organizations that want to adopt a healthy meeting policy and plan a healthier meeting. And we would love to help out anyone who's interested in planning healthier meetings with their organization. So please reach out to us.
I like that. And that could be just for, you know, the typical person who works for the company, or it's really for the person who organizes meetings and makes those catering purchases to sign.
Well, I think anyone can be the champion for trying to improve the food environment in the workplace. So try to take it up the chain.
Right. All right, I love it. Healthymeeting.org. That's great. Very actionable. And Spike.
I think I got one.
Okay.
Drink a glass of buttermilk.
I've never done that.
You should.
Because why? Why should we do that?
Buttermilk is underappreciated. It will last. It's cultured. It's delicious. It is low cost. It's low fat or no fat. It'll last in your fridge for a long time. You can keep it around. You can bake with it. And when you drink it, it's delicious. And it's just a great thing. And find a small local dairy that's struggling, because they all are, and buy their buttermilk, because it'll help them out, because they're making money off of butter and cream. So buy their buttermilk and treat yourself.
Sounds refreshing.
It's
summer.
Awesome.
Summer,
yeah, summer's
in
here.
DC.
And you can make incredible soups with it, cold soups. And it's just, but just the first thing is open it up and pour yourself a little glass and drink it, and you'll be amazed.
Have you ever done that, Jesse?
I have not.
Today's the day. I'm very excited.
Buttermilk all around.
I love cooking with it, but yes. And I like sour things, so can't wait to tell my whole family about that. Very specific. Good job. Okay, so we're going to sign off. And I just want to say that, you know, one of the things that I really like about this topic also is that institutional eaters are often forgotten because they don't have a choice. And I really appreciated, Spike, you talking about how most of the guests at the conferences that you're doing the buffets for haven't elected to source from the producers that you're working with. And it's even more so if you're a patient in a hospital, like who, you know, what we're going to be talking about next week in the series. Or, you know, of course, if you're living in a correctional facility where, needless to say, you have even less agency in your food choices. You know, Dan Giusti, the chef that I played the clip from in the beginning, said institutions have, quote, a captive audience. So you can get away with having low standards because you're not competing with anyone. So I've appreciated your perspectives in terms of, you know, market demand needing to change, Spike. And hopefully there will be new entrants to this category of really mindful, locally sourced hotel food. And Jesse, thank you for kind of like putting stakes in the ground on this and holding hotels accountable. Now I know Radisson Blu,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Is a good one to seek out.
Yeah, thank you for being interested in this.
absolutely. What kind of study are you doing next on in the institutional food sphere that people should look out for?
So right now we are convening a work group of experts in adopting healthy food service guidelines in a number of different institutional settings. So we're trying to see who's been successful in adopting guidelines in different settings and how they've been able to do that and what kind of best practices can we disseminate to people working in this space.
Cool. So kind of taking them out of their silos of what type of institution they are. To make it more approachable.
Yeah, for sure.
Great. And I want everyone to know that if they want to stay in touch with Jesse's work, they can follow you on Twitter at CSPI, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instagram at CSPI_nutrition action.
Yep.
I only found Rakes Progress on Instagram at @RakesProgressDC. Anywhere else that you would want listeners to follow your journey, Spike?
Come in and eat. It's on the plate. It's not online.
And I just heard exciting news about more Spike eating establishments in D.C.
We're working on it.
So stay tuned for that. Well, great. Thank you both for taking the time to kick off this series with me. And as I mentioned earlier, next week I'll be talking with a hospital chef and a healthcare food service expert who work in Philadelphia hospitals to improve the quality of their ingredients. So I will talk to you then. Thanks for tuning into Lunch Agenda today.